I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. Race, implicit bias, stereotypes. All topics that often have us squirming in our seats when they're brought up. There's the fear of being perceived as racist or insensitive. There are accusations of being too sensitive or of race baiting. Nevertheless, these are topics that need to be addressed, as we've seen a rise in hate crimes across the country. According to the FBI's hate crime statistics for 2017, which is the most recent year available, there was an increase from the previous year in almost every category of bias, including bias against race, ethnicity, and ancestry. To tackle this subject, The Day has partnered with Connecticut College to host a series of conversations on race. The first guest speaker was the Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court, Richard A. Robinson, the state's first African-American Chief Justice. He sat down with court's reporter Karen Florin for a wide-ranging discussion on race. Here's audio from the event, which took place on Wednesday, November 6, on the Connecticut College campus, with more than 300 people in the audience.
Hello, New London. My work is basically done because we're here and we're talking, right? I need my notes. Reporters can't do anything without paper in front of them. Coming into tonight's event, we've already had a lot of conversations in the newsroom, in the community, in court, and not a few people. Several people asked me, hey, Florin, what makes you an expert on this topic? And I said, well, no, actually, I'm not an expert. What I'm an expert at is finding experts. So Chief Justice Robinson has been nothing but accommodating, has not once said no to anything that we've asked of him. And I just want to thank you again for coming tonight. And clearly there's some interest in what you have to say here. So maybe we'll start, like they do in court, by qualifying you as an expert.
I'm not used to being on this end of that.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Justice Robinson.
I was born in Stanford. I am a boomer, but only at the tail end of being a boomer. I have two brothers. I'm the middle child, which explains a lot of my behaviors. Great family. My mom is alive. She's not well. Dad passed on a few years ago. One of the things I like to talk about my mother and father is my mother was 5'9 and my dad was 5'2. And so, and when I started dating, it caused some problems. But I, as I said, born and raised in Stanford. I became went to law school, became a city attorney, first African American city attorney for the city of Stanford, and it was great. And worked for a guy, little known now, named Daniel Malloy.
We heard of him.
he was the one who actually nominated me to the Supreme Court, and to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I had the luxury or the pleasure, had sort of an odd history. I was originally nominated by a Republican. I was elevated to the appellate court by a Republican. I was put on the Supreme Court by a Democrat and the Chief Justice by a Democrat. So despite what you may feel about Connecticut politics, they're a lot less polarized than in most places in this country.
Thank you. We heard a couple of harrowing stories over dinner with Chief Justice that maybe he'll share with us in a little while, but here's another question that I got, and don't worry, folks, that submitted questions, because I have them here and I'm ready to use them in a little while. Here's a question I got more than once also. Why are you guys even talking about race? Why is this necessary? One person told me, race is over.
I've heard that too. Unfortunately, it's not over. And if you look at what we've, for the last 400 years in this country, We haven't talked about race. We haven't been comfortable about talking about race. Barack Obama became president of the United States, and a lot of folks thought that our racial problems would end with that. But as you can see, when he tried to talk about race, it was often a very uncomfortable situation for all Americans. So we need to talk about race. We need to have these conversations because, quite frankly, if we don't have them, then we stick with the stereotypes and the fear and those kinds of things, and we have to get past that. For this country to survive, we have to get past that.
So help us. It's really hard to talk about race, yeah. And sometimes we say things that hurt one another's feelings. I think I've heard you say something about the ouch moments. How do you get over those moments and keep talking rather than shutting down? And can you give us some examples?
Well, you have to look at the long-term goal. And what I've done with my friends is I've had the conversation with them to say we can have those oops and ouch moments because you're gonna have them, we're human beings. One of the problems with race is there's this other thing that's going on, which is implicit bias. And I talk about that a lot. And implicit bias is you are associating things together. You have a lifetime of receiving images and sounds about other people. And you can consciously reject those things. But sometimes in your mind, you're putting them together and not knowing it. I wish I had brought the Stroop test and other tests like that. But I do this one thing where there's a picture of a snake, and it's what's called a king snake. Those of you from the South know what the king snake is. It's a banded snake, and it's red and black and yellow. But there's a coral snake, which is also red, black, and yellow. Now, if you were sitting on a rock and a snake comes from under the rock and it's about to bite you, you look down and you're trying to figure out whether this is a king snake or a coral snake, there's an old saying, if it's red near black, you're okay, Jack. If it's red near yellow, if it's red near yellow, you're a deadly fellow. So if you're trying to figure out this rhyme while the snake is about to bite you, and the snake's biting you and you're going like, which one is it? Which one? And he's, oh, I'm feeling sleepy. It's the other one. That doesn't do you any good. So you look, you go, snake, and you jump away. That's what I do. But when you're using your people assessments, that's not a good thing. And I'm the Chief Justice of Connecticut Supreme Court, yet when I walk down the street, even dressed like this, I hear car doors lock. And it's one of those moments where as a black man, you kind of go, it's happening again. And then you pick yourself up and you go on. But that's happening. That's the kind of thing we need to talk about. Why is that happening? Why are these associations in the back of our head? So with my friends, I'm open and honest about it. And there's some times where I kind of go, oops, and ouch, and those things, and you have to permit that. You have to permit your friends, your associates, to make mistakes and get past those mistakes, or else the conversation's gonna stop.
Is this a topic that we can joke about?
Humor is very dangerous. I would stay away from humor, especially with people you don't know well. And when you get it wrong, that's an open and ouch moment. But the problem with jokes is there's usually something that's not so funny about it. There's usually a stereotype behind that. And so when you're joking about it, it's like, ha-ha, but you end up not feeling so good, you know, after the joke is told.
One of the things that we are fascinated with, especially as journalists, is the constantly evolving language of race, right? So when, you know, those boomers grew up, there were different words to describe the people that we now describe as African American or black, or lately I even hear black and brown people, right? Are you hearing that one?
Yes.
Is it okay for you to say to somebody, you know, I'd rather be called, well, you'd probably rather be called Chief Justice or Rick, right? But, you know, how can people feel free to actually bring this up? When I meet you, I kind of just want to meet you and not have to talk about our races.
Right. And we don't have to talk about that at first. We can wait until we're more comfortable with each other before we talk about that. And as far as what a person wants to be called, we just had Diversity Week with the Judicial Branch. We have it every year. And we we have trainings for our employees in order to be able to deal with each other in a better way. And the reason why we do that is because in order to have true access to justice, you have to be culturally competent. You have to not step on people's toes. Because we actually did a study, it was about, I don't think how many years ago it was. I have two of my external affairs people here. I guess about 15 years ago now, where we did a study. And people felt that the quality of justice differed by their age, by their race, by their gender, by their color, by their religion. So you had people coming into the court and thinking, my justice will be different from somebody else's justice. The problem with that is the judicial branch has no real power to enforce its edicts. We don't. The reason why people follow us is because they trust us. They trust us to do the right thing. When we slip up, believe me, it's big. And there's been some slip-ups in the past. But in order to get people to trust us, we have to be culturally competent and really understand how not to step on people's toes.
Blacks okay, African Americans okay,
right?
Black and brown.
It depends on who you're talking to, and so the best way. Oh, that's where I was going with the diversity week thing. We were talking about gender, and you know, it's a very tough thing because we're now seeing that gender isn't binary.
Yes.
Gender is a spectrum. So a person may want to be called he, she, or some other pronouns. So ask them, what's your gender preference? What's your word you want?
How soon after meeting somebody should we ask them that? I know a lot of people are now sort of putting a little tagline on their, you know, on their when they sign off on a letter or an email or something that says pronouns, you know,
right.
He, him.
What's your pronoun?
Mm-hmm. And so I like that. It tells me where you're at. It tells me who you are. But
yeah,
how soon do we bring these things up and how do we bring these?
I think out of the blue is not a good idea. But if you're talking and the subject of race comes up, it's like, you know, I prefer to be called black. You know, what's your preference? It should be part of the conversation. But I can understand people not wanting to go there because you don't want to be seen as being a racist. You don't want to be seen as being insensitive. That's why that oops, ouch thing really comes in. If the person says, well, hey, look, I don't want to talk about that, then you can back off and you talk about something else. But eventually you'll become comfortable enough to talk to each other about these really critical things. With my close friend, the Prouses, we have some really deep conversations. They're white, they're blonde hair, blue eyes, and we travel with them. And during our travels, we take the opportunity to discuss things that may have happened. Let me give you an example. We went to this hotel, and the Prouses checked in. After that, during the check-in, they were asked to upgrade several times. And so this was New Orleans, and they ended up with this suite and, you know, on Bourbon Street and the whole routine. When my wife and I walked up, we were just checked in, and we ended up all the way in the back of the hotel. Now, a lot of you may think that the clerk for them was white and the clerk for me was white. No, the clerk for them was white, the clerk for me was black. But remember what I said about implicit biases? My belief is that she didn't think I could afford all these upgrades and things, so she never offered them to me. Now, it cost the hotel a lot of money because I would have liked the upgrade, but by then I was so angry that they didn't ask me, I didn't do it. So implicit bias isn't something that just white people have. It's something we all have. And so we actually had that conversation. I asked them, I said, did you see what happened? They said, what are you talking about? So I explained it. I said, you know, you were given the opportunity to upgrade, we weren't. We ended up in the back of the hotel, you didn't. Why did that happen? And so was it race, was it not race, was it bias? And we had this open, honest conversation. And I think it was wonderful.
And they were probably kind of embarrassed.
They were, but you
and frustrated too, you know, our friends are being, you know, not treated equally, you know.
Sure, there were a number of different incidents, and some of them weren't so great. My wife looks very biracial. And sometimes people have a very difficult time trying to determine what box she fits in, when most of us don't fit in any particular box. When you look at me, you say African-American. Look at you, you say white. Little do you know that I have English ancestry, and actually my ancestors were slave owners. The black side of my family were slave owners. So there's all these surprises. But race is so difficult. And think about how we put people in these little categories when I honestly don't know what race is. When you think about it, is if you looked at my DNA, you could not see African American. If you look at me, you see my appearance. And so is race biological? Is race a social construct? Is it both? That's a conversation I'd like to have. But it's so important, yet no one can ever define what it is.
And I think a lot of this conversation also touches on several other things, right? Like culture, ethnicity. Of course, how many people are you overseeing in the judicial branch?
3,600.
So you've got, you know, a lot of different people, a lot of different groups.
Yes.
When we write newspaper stories for the day, we are often making an effort to be colorblind, right? So I've covered entire trials of, you know, white people, all white people, or white defendant, you know, black lawyer, whatever. And never do I mention race in the whole entire series of stories,
right.
No matter who's involved. And that, in a way, I feel is not quite, it doesn't quite feel right either, because I'm not really describing people, you know. And you had said something in your interview earlier about, you know, colorblind's not a good idea either. Could you expound on that a little bit?
When I do presentations on cultural competency and implicit bias, one of the things I talk about is that you have to look at people. When we first see people, think of an iceberg. You see 10% of who they really are. You see what they look like. You may be able to tell gender, but as I already said, gender can be very complicated. It's a spectrum. It's not binary. You might be able to see color. You might be able to see religion. You can see some things about their socioeconomic status. But we're already making value decisions about these people based on this 10%. But the 90%, what you really need to know about them, about how they think, how they live, how they work, who they are, that's all below that waterline. And so if you think of people as icebergs, don't judge on that top 10%. Because when you saw me walk on the stage, you saw a black man. And I want you to acknowledge that. You saw a black man. A really good-looking black man. But you saw a black man. And the reason why I'm saying you have to acknowledge that is because you need to know what you're doing with that information. If you don't know what you're doing with that information, then you could be making these leaps in association. You could be making these value judgments on me based on these stereotypes. And I'm not saying that you're racist. I'm saying that you have to be very careful about what's in the back of your mind. Judges tend to do things sometimes with their gut. The problem is we aren't trained to use our guts, and our guts can be a sign that we're using implicit bias. So if I see a defendant and I'm setting bail, for example, and it's like, you know, something about this guy makes me feel kind of squirrely. If I set a high bond on that person and they can't get out, the end result will be they'll have a longer sentence just because of that first association I made. Because every study shows that the length of time you will actually serve is dependent on the first time you set bond. So you have to make sure that you aren't putting bias into the situation. You have to start asking those questions. I actually had a young man before me once, African American, and I felt uncomfortable. There's something about it. He had done a sort of a knuckleheaded crime. It didn't hurt anybody, but it was kind of a stupid thing. And I was about to set a bond, and I realized something is making me uncomfortable. What is that? And so I'm asking questions, and then I realized, I come from a nuclear family. My dad, my mom would have been at this courthouse, and I would have been telling the judge, please don't let me go home with these people. They're going to kill me. But this young man didn't have anybody there with him. And so I realized that was making me uncomfortable. So I said to myself, why aren't his parents here? I started asking the questions I need to find out why his parents were. Turns out they were new immigrants. They didn't know the system. They didn't know how important it was for them to be there. And most of all, they didn't know what kind of trouble he was in. So I eventually had the family come down. And then I, quite frankly, was afraid to release them to him because they were like my parents. It was like, I don't know if I should let this kid go home with them. So the prosecutor saw all this too, and the prosecutor ended up offering him a pretrial diversionary program so he didn't have to burn an AR. I heard from this family for years about how well this kid was doing. Imagine if I didn't do what I did.
What a great story. And AR for everybody who doesn't follow the courts. Accelerated rehabilitation, which is kind of like your chance, your get out of jail free card, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets one of them.
Right, but you want to save that for something special.
Can you talk a little bit more about the presentation that you do in the court system and beyond on cultural competency? Do you tailor it for individual audiences based on what they do?
And I do.
What is it all about?
I do. I told you some of it. I do a lot of training with implicit bias, along with Justice Maria Kahn. And one of the first things we do is we stand on stage and we talk about a little bit about our backgrounds. And I say something obvious. I said, well, if you look at Justice Kahn and you look at me, which one of us is from Africa? And everybody points at me. She's from Africa. She's Portuguese. She was born in Angola. And so I use that to show people how we make these really quick decisions about people. And mostly I do judge training, because think about how the courts used to be. They were this mysterious black box with a bunch of very homogenous looking people who were doing these really powerful things. Courts have changed a lot since then. We have a more diverse bench. We have a more diverse judiciary. Are we perfect? The answer to that is no. We do a lot of training. We will keep doing a lot of training. I heard a statement today about moving horizons. That's absolutely true. The truth of the matter is we will need this kind of training until the day we die. You just won't get it perfect. And that's one of the things I worry about. People say, well, when can we stop talking about this? When can we stop doing these trainings? The truth of it is, never. We like to put things in groups. We like to associate things. We like to take shortcuts when we make decisions about people. It probably is, if you believe that in evolution, it probably is an evolutionary factor, because you had to really determine really quickly who was your enemy and who was not your enemy. Sort of like the snake thing. But now that's in our society. We live with each other. We interact with each other. We have court systems. We have police officers. We have all these things where people make these snap judgment decisions, sometimes on faulty information. And that's what my program's about. It's about getting you to slow your thinking down, get off of autopilot, really get the information you need to make those other decisions about people.
And what are some of the ways that you can get that information in a sort of efficient and safe way?
One of the things, if you're interested in implicit bias, I know implicit bias is controversial. There actually is something called Harvard Project Implicit, and if you just Google implicit bias, you'll see the test. And there's all kinds of tests about people's biases. There's short, tall, black, white, heavy, thin, all these things that you can try and see whether you are associating things together that you shouldn't be. It doesn't tell you that you're a bad person, doesn't tell you you're a good person. It just tells you your brain is doing something with information that you may not be aware of. And study after study after study shows that if you are made aware of that, then you can start working yourself to make the unconscious conscious and deal with it. You know, as a judge, I can start making those decisions about people who are not in nuclear families, or people who don't look like me, or people who have a different religion. I can go, wait a minute, hold it. I'm feeling uncomfortable, why am I doing that? feeling real comfortable. Why am I doing that? I was hiring law clerks, and there was this one gentleman who came in, and he was kind of okay. And then he mentioned this one thing, and I loved him. he went to West Virginia University, which is the school I went to. So I was like, oh, he's perfect. Could have been a serial killer for all I know.
Let's go to some of the questions from the audience, because they are really good. These were submitted ahead of time, and then in a little while, we're also going to have some of you come down and ask some questions. This one is from Joanne Key, and she says, as you progress in your career and achieve desirable outcomes, you come under more scrutiny and criticism. Can you give some examples on how you are able to overcome the potential pitfalls when succeeding while black?
So the toughest question first, huh?
I thought that was a good one. Thanks, Joanne.
It's a very good question, and it's a hard thing to do. When I was nominated to become a justice of the Supreme Court, Governor Malloy held a news conference. And one of the questions that the press asked was, Fleming Norcott was an African American, and Richard Robinson is an African American. Did that have something to do with his appointment? And I thought the governor handled it in an interesting way, in a way that I liked. He looked at me and said, isn't it your birthday? And I said, yes. I've had this sort of freakish career where almost all my promotions were on my birthday. And he said, how long have I known you? And I said, I think we met in either 71 or 72 in high school. He was the class president, athlete guy, I was the nerd. And then he said, you went to law school, and I went to law school, and then I was on the Board of Finance, and you were my attorney. And I said, yes. And he said, when I became the mayor of the city of Stamford, how many years were you the attorney then? And I said, it was 4 years under your administration. So he looked at the reporter and said, I've known this man longer than any of my other nominees. Why would you ask that question? The reason why that stands out in my mind is because race became so important at that moment, and I'm trying to figure out why. Why was race so important? And I thought the governor handled it in a really good way. I picked this guy because I know him. He happens to be African American, and it helps me with my efforts to diversify the court, but I know him. So I've had a career where I was the first of a lot of things, and it would always point back to the racial issue. And the problem for me was, well, wait a minute, you're removing all my other qualifications and saying this is just because you're a black man. In the commentary section, I believe, of one of your articles, I was reading that, and people were saying I was unqualified to become Chief Justice. But I had a law degree. I was an attorney for 16 years. I was a Superior Court judge for 6 years. I was an Appellate Court judge for 7 years. And I was a Supreme Court justice for 5 years. So I had more experience than most people, more diverse experience, legal experience, and court experience than most people who were on the court. Yet I was questioned about that. So sometimes it gets you down. And I know with young people, it's so tiring. It really is. I was doing a presentation at, can I mention another school?
Of course.
I was doing a presentation at University of New Haven, and an African-American young woman came up to me, and she said, I'm so tired. I'm so tired of this fight. And I looked at her, and I said, here's the thing, though. You're always going to be black. You always will have this fight. And I was saddened to have to tell her that, but I always will be black, and I always will have some of these issues. When I walk into a department store, I'm treated differently than when you walk into a department store. Sometimes I want to just shake the person and say, do you know who I am? And it quite frankly, there, when I was a judge, there was a funny moment where a person sort of did something like that, and then she saw me on the bench in the robe, and it was like, So there are some humorous moments. But you can't change that. So the thing is, what can you do with that? What positive things you can make out of it? And that's what I've been doing with my career. I've been trying to get people to talk about these things and why it's this way. Because the thing I've always wondered is, what happens if the one person who could cure cancer is an inner city black kid who doesn't have a chance? You know, what happens? And so it's like, I don't want that to happen. I want people to have the chance for things. And it's not that I want to take something from somebody else. Equality is not a pie. We could all have a fair, have equality, and it won't run out. So it's not like that pie where you start taking pieces out and there's nothing left. It's not that I want more rights than you. It's not that I want your rights. I just want an equal stance. I want to be at the table with you, because I think we can both be better if I am.
Next question. There seems to be an increased fragility and sensitivity about this topic, which has caused some people to fear speaking freely, since it could cause a backlash or stereotyping of their views. How do we overcome this and have real public discourse? This is from Charles Coiro.
Charles, this is a really great question. And it's a very difficult question to answer, because I'm a human being, and there's times when somebody will say something that triggers me, and I want to respond in a way that's inappropriate for that moment. But I've realized that in order to have this continuing conversation, I have to sit back and listen. My fourth grade teacher, Janet Harris, said, there's a reason why we have two, you know, we have one mouth and two ears. So you have to listen twice as carefully. And sometimes people say things out of ignorance. Sometimes they say because they have a strong belief in it. If I get triggered and don't have this conversation, a conversation is a dialogue, and you have to keep coming back and going forward. If you give up at the beginning of that dialogue, all's lost, and we won't make any advancements. And that's sort of the quagmire we're stuck in now. We have to get past that. We have to think about it. The most segregated day of the week is Sunday. And our homes are really segregated. And I've made sure that for the sake of my kids and the sake of my own sanity and my wife's and everything else, that we actually have people who are of different religions over the house, of different, you know, beliefs, of different color. And we go over other people's houses, and we make the conscious effort to do that. So you have to make this conscious effort to be uncomfortable. Race sometimes uncomfortable. I'm used to speaking to people. I'm used to speaking to, recently I did a presentation in Virginia with the Virginia judiciary. It was 400 judges, and they were all elected judges. And so I wanted to have a conversation about that. Well, how do you follow the rule of law when you're an elected judge? So I was having conversations with them. And it was in the South. And that was sort of in my mind too. But I sat down and I had conversations. And I had unbelievable conversations. And the people who came up to me after the presentation were the older white male judges. And I said, okay, this is interesting. I was able to find that place where they didn't feel that they were being talked down to. They didn't feel that they were being called racist. They didn't feel that they were being run out of the room. It takes an effort. You have to get out of your comfort zone.
So there's a program going on here in New London called Encountering Differences. And I know some of you are out there. And kind of prompted by some problems at athletic games, I guess that's, you know, like people are pretty intense at those games.
Sure.
And it's really as simple sometimes, I think, as going and having dinner with, you know, if you're white, going over to a black family's house, eating their food and hanging out.
Food works.
I think food works. But, you know, so that's one thing I always say, and maybe it's tending to oversimplify, but once you get to know somebody, you know, we have a great community of immigrants here in New London, and during all of this ICE stuff in the courthouse, and we're writing about it, and But I'm going over and meeting people, and I'm talking to them, and I'm hearing about their food and their lives, and their, it's like, you know, wait a minute, you're in Mars, like we're in New London, you know? And is that oversimplifying, though? Is it enough that we're hanging out together, spending time together, or are things still going to, are we still going to have, you know, conflict?
You're still going to have conflict, but that's okay. I mean, the whole thing is, as I said, it's uncomfortable to do it sometimes, but until we start having these conversations, and you got to start out with the dinners and inviting people over your house and getting rid of some of those assumptions that you make. One of the things I talk about in my training is, let's say you have a law firm, and you're trying to figure out which one of these new attorneys are on the partnership track, and you love playing golf. You absolutely love golf. But one of your new associates happens to be a black female, and you go, you know what? She's not gonna like golf. But the problem is, if that's your partnership track, if that's how you start to get to know your associates, and you don't invite that person because of your implicit bias, you think this black woman doesn't play golf. Now, you didn't exclude her because you were black, but you did. So you have to get past those things. You have to sort of get off this autopilot and realize how you start making these partnership tracks, how you hire people, how you associate with people, and try to figure out what you're doing. Why are you feeling uncomfortable and uncomfortable? And I think if you do that, if you get off of the autopilot, which is not easy, but if you get off that autopilot, you'll be able to make headway into those other situations.
So how long into the relationship do we start looking at one another as, you know, not the other?
Right. I think it's like any other relationship. You know when you start feeling more comfortable with a person and when you don't. The thing is to get past that, this person's strange to me, I don't want to talk to this person, or this person's not going to like me, or the big one is, this person's going to think I'm racist. Because if that's where you're going to stop, you're never going to have that conversation. And as well as the other side too, as a black person, I have to sit there and go, okay, my instinct is saying that this person's not woke, this person doesn't understand me, this person is saying things that trigger me. If I stop there, I don't get anywhere either. And so we both have to sort of get uncomfortable, even though it's the R word.
Yeah. Okay. Audience question. What is the most pressing issue that is disproportionately affecting the minority population in the criminal justice system, and what can be done? No problem.
Well, one of the biggest problems is the prisoner industrial complex. The way we incarcerate people and the rates that we incarcerate people. I find it interesting when I'm having some of these difficult conversations, some will say, but blacks commit more crimes. And it's like, that's not true. If you think about where crime is enforced, it's enforced in urban areas. And so if you have people concentrated in one area and you're doing more enforcement there, you're going to have more arrests there. Then you have the implicit bias problem on top of that. I can remember as a kid, I was in the 01 groups, which is the honor groups when I was a kid. I was often the only African American in my class. So I had friends who were white when I was at school and friends who were black at home. And so I lived in these two different worlds. And I felt that I was too black to be white and too white to be black. I was sort of called, I was called Poindexter and names like that. But I didn't feel like I fit in either world, but I was communicating with both worlds. So, this was the 60s and 70s, and people smoked herb, you know. So the black kids, when they would smoke marijuana, the cops would arrest them. When my white friends who were up in North Stanford, the cop would either tell them to stop or take them home. And so you had the same situation, but you had a different result. You now had this young black person who had a criminal record, which really would ruin the track that they were on. and you had this young white person who was, you know, sometimes kids cause problems. And I'm not saying the cop was racist. I'm saying the cop had biases. The cop was thinking that this person needs this kind of punishment, and this person needs this kind of punishment. But think about what happens to society if you do that. You start incarcerating blacks at a higher rate than you do whites. And as I said, blacks tend to be in a more concentrated urban area. So the prison industrial complex is a huge thing. The other thing is that, remember I said about people started thinking that the quality of justice was different based on their race or their gender?
Yes.
So people would lose faith in our governmental institutions because of the way the institutions treated them or that they perceived they were being treated. So those are real problems. That's really why I'm into doing this implicit bias training, to get people to understand that these problems exist and we need to get past this.
And as our first black chief justice, do people sort of expect you to fix it all pretty quickly, you know? Are you, I know that you talk about Justice Khan, you work with her together on some of these efforts. Can one man do that in one term? How are you setting the stage for it to continue?
Sometimes it's a burden that seems too heavy to bear. But I do know that I feel that I have a special responsibility. And what I try to do is get other people to understand that because I'm in this place and I can do these things, I need your help to make these changes. And I think that works. I think the culture of the branch is changing because now you have not only from the bottom up, from the employees and the employees of color and everything else saying, hey, look, we need to make changes here. But you have me on the top trying to do it from the top, and hopefully we'll meet in the middle and make these changes. And I think everybody's better off because of those changes. Because one of the problems with the perception now, and I think it's a very real issue that we need to deal with, white males feel they're being left out. They're feeling that they are losing that piece of the pie. And so it can't possibly be the way that we fix that is to ignore them. It can't possibly be the way to fix that is to not address their concerns. They have to be part of the conversation. And they're really important people to bring into the conversation. Sometimes it's difficult. But often when I do my presentations, that person is my target. The person who's sitting there, you know, that person's my target. Because if I can't bring them in, I can't get things done.
Wow. That was a great question, A. Green. Next question. Why are so many okay with staying silent? Why are so many unwilling to recognize their implicit racism? Alex Wade.
I think that my first answer to that would be I think a lot of people don't know that they have implicit bias and they don't realize that they're racist because they're in a culture where this behavior is okay. It's only when you start getting out of that into other cultures that it becomes a problem for you. People tend to gravitate towards people who think like them. You know, it's easy, it's comforting. One of the things I do when I hire term clerks is the first thing I tell them is, I don't want an echo chamber. I don't need people who think exactly like I do. You're no use to me if you think exactly like I do. Push back. Tell me I'm wrong when I'm wrong. My permanent clerk does that a little too much, but actually my permanent clerk is wonderful. I could not do my job without, plug for John Wiener. I could not do it without John Wiener. But it's very comforting to have people who think like you. And I think that's why we're having this polarization of society. People are sticking with people who think exactly like them. I'd much rather, and for the students here, I gotta tell you, this is going to be hard. One of the things about the school system, the university system, is you're here to hear ideas that are different from yours. You are here to be with cultures that are different from yours. You are here at this very critical point of your life to experience things that are unlike those things that happen in the comfort of your home. And that's tough. It's tough hearing a different idea, especially when you think that yours is right. And so when you hear this, when you see this strangeness, You can either run from it, you can embrace it, you can tolerate it, you can deal with it. I'm saying do something more towards the middle than the extreme. You know, hang out with people who are different from you. And I'm not just saying a different religion. I'm saying a different way of thinking. If you're progressive, find some conservative friends. It's tough. But one of the most pleasurable experiences I had as a judge, I hired a term clerk who was really conservative. And we had the best conversations that I could ever think of.
Now, at the end of those conversations, was that person more, you know, were you meeting more in the middle on some issues, or did you still end up where you began, but getting along any better?
I think we both became more tolerant of each other's ideas, and it was amazing. I won't say his name, but he's a very successful appellate lawyer now, and I'm so proud of him. And we still have those difficult conversations, but it was rewarding. And not only did, and I feel that I did, not only did I change him, but he changed me. And it was for the best.
Excellent. Okay, next question. What would be the best way to create a dialogue to support all people? And that one's by Margaret Richards.
What's the best way? I think the best way is to not be phony. You can't turn off yourself. You need to be who you are. And the whole thing is, if you can do that and the other person can do that in the same space, you're both gonna be better off. But you have to be tolerant, you have to be patient. You're not gonna get this right at the first time you talk. You're not gonna get this right the 25th time that you talk. You're gonna work on that if it's a lifetime friend for a lifetime. But it's worth it.
And you know, I think that's true of all sort of human interactions.
I agree.
Right?
Because if a relationship is worth it to you, you're gonna work on that relationship. And so I'm saying that it's worth it to work with other people too.
Love it. Next question. Oh boy. How do we counter harmful social media? By Gabriella Schlesinger. Justice Robinson, are you on social media?
I keep thinking about the former Chief Justice when she found out that I had a Facebook account.
Oh!
Ooh. I am on social media. I don't use it that much. Quite frankly, it does keep me in touch with family and friends. And a lot of you folks don't know, I'm a martial artist. I'm a fourth degree black belt. My wife is a sixth degree black belt. And she's my instructor. And people often ask, have we sparred? And we sparred twice. And you know what? Winning isn't everything.
So you are on social media. It's harmful. It's good and bad.
It can be, because when people feel that they have the shield of anonymity, they'll say things that they won't say otherwise. And then you have this whole troll phenomenon, which I don't get how people want to hurt somebody just because it's somehow fun to them. I'm not sure what you can do about social media except for regulate yourself and how you use it. One of the things that I found out, it was like there's this myth, and I do think it's a myth, that younger people are always more open to the things that we're talking about tonight. The young people are less racist. But I don't know if you've ever listened to, my son plays Xbox, and he plays these games, these open games where you have other people. And Jonathan, when he talks, he sounds like an educated person. And so he got into this conversation with these other people, and they started talking, saying some really horrendous things about black people. And John goes, well, you know I'm black, right? And they cursed him out. They called him a liar. It says, you don't talk like a black person. I'm not sure what that means. But
yeah.
So it's like when people are behind that curtain, they'll say some things that they normally wouldn't say. So social media is tricky.
I know. And a lot of people have said, well, especially in recent years with recent national events, well, at least we know how people really feel now, right?
See, I'm not sure if they really feel that way. I think that sometimes you put on a mask, you become this other person. It's almost like you're stripped of your, you know, there's id, ego, and super ego. You're stripped of your super ego, and you just become pure id. You become pure just hostile, and you get all this emotion out that you normally, you know, that's not acceptable in society. So is that the real person, or is the person somewhere in the middle? I don't know.
That's
but
really
I think
interesting.
It can bring out the worst in people.
Can we just have another round of applause for both Karen and for Justin?